Hi, happy Diwali. You're listening to episode 60 of Attention Please with Arnab Ray, and I'm Vikram Mohan. We've had a lot of stuff going on as usual, and we've had a couple of state elections. We had Dada taking over the BCCI and US lawmakers discussing India of all things. So let's get our host and ask him about all of this. But first, hey Arnab.
Hello and happy Diwali to everyone.
Happy Diwali to you too, Arnab. And I'm going to ask you the same thing which I asked you last year around this time. You love Halloween, we know that. So what's your theme for this year?
So this year I'm actually dressing up as an old woman. So as we have been told that we can self-identify. Last time I self-identified as the Joker, which was a year before.
Right.
This year before this movie. So this time I've decided to go as an old woman. I brought a mask, you know, an old dead woman, I should say. And like her face is tilted to the side slightly. I really like that look. And there's going to be a black gown that I'm going to wear. It's this black generic gown I've worn. I think I've had that since 2003.
Like a witch's costume?
It's not like a witch's costume. It's more like it's basically a black, it's like, I think the Bengali word for it is a jobba. So it's a black jobba.
It's jobba. In Tamil, in South India, we call it jibba.
Okay, so it's exactly that, and you can wear it for anything. I think I've gone as a haunted priest, and I've always worn that. The only thing it doesn't work for is vampire, but other than that, it's a pretty generic cost. It's a pretty generic thing that you can.
Just what about your daughter? What's her theme this year?
So she dressed as a witch, and so today she went to. So we have a membership at the local YMCA. You know, YMCA used to be at one point of time. The acronym was Young Men's Christian Association.
Right.
And that's so wrong in this day and age for so many reasons. I think they've changed it to the Y, like the KFC. It's now called the Y. And I don't think anybody asks where. Yeah, so it's branded as the Y. I don't think, I mean, they do put YMCA, but there's no acronym. They never say what the full form of YMCA is, and they like to be referred to as the Y.
Like you said, like KFC.
Yes. So we went there. This was an older costume that she wore, where she dressed up as Harley Quinn. Last year, my wife dressed up as Harley Quinn. I dressed up as the Joker. So this time she dressed up, my daughter dressed up as a witch.
So there's no family theme as such going around?
No, we normally don't do a family theme. It's very difficult to actually get a family theme unless you go for humor. And I just never go for humor. I mean, today we went to that Y event. So it was a Halloween themed event. And they had like a petting zoo. I don't know what a petting zoo has to do with Halloween, by the way. But they were but they were trick-or-treating. And there were you know, families which had dressed up. I saw there was a family which had dressed up as, everybody was dressed up as the genie. That the husband was dressed up as the genie, and the wife was dressed up as, I think, a lady genie. Normally we don't do family things. Except, as I said, last year, at least my wife and I did, Harley and Joker.
How brown are these events? How many DCs do you see?
No, the DCs are they're virtually absent in these events. So the place where I stay, by the way, we had another devastating fire this week.
Yes,
I'm really scared. I didn't know these things were this bad. Maybe it's just become suddenly bad, but pretty much every place that I've ever gone to, and I don't drive too many places, has now been burned down, essentially. So the Santa Clarita is that area, the other area that I go to. Porto Ranch is where I stay, and Santa Clarita had a huge fire. So in the last 2 weeks, I mean, it was like only 2 weeks ago, I think, 2 or 3 weeks ago that we were evacuated here. And now we had another event. We had to pack everything up. I packed. This time I was much better prepared. So the moment I came to know that there was a fire in Santa Clarita, which is a bit north of where we stay, but still, fires can travel. I came home early from work, because I knew that all the highways were going to be blocked. And even while I was going there, the traffic was much more than I'd ever experienced, because emergency vehicles were basically blocking the road and going the other way. And
So this was, again, we packed our bags, we were ready to go, but fortunately the fire never came this way. In a way, because everything this way has already been burned 2 weeks ago, so it's unlikely that they will burn again, because there's really nothing to burn over here anymore. But it just goes to show the kind of existential threat that California living brings about. I don't think there's any other place in the U.S. And this is something which I struggle to understand. So I wish I had the answer to this. Is that why do people stay in this place? I mean, we have Hollywood here, like 10 miles to the south. Right. And the richest people in the world who could stay anywhere in the world if they chose to, still choose to live here, which is a place which can be flattened by an earthquake at any point of time. So if you say, okay, well, I live in a place where there are no trees nearby, well, it won't save you from the earthquake. And second is that even with, and what we've seen here is that often because of the winds, it's not, the houses near the brambles and the bushes aren't the ones that are worst affected. It's sometimes houses which are one or two rows down because the wind actually carries it there. It happened here in my locality. My house is straight next to the hills where there are shrubs. But that caught fire, but the fire went, the sparks went over my house and hit the house on the next street. So there's nobody who's safe. It's like a crapshoot. So again, it's not, you know, considering the number of houses there are and considering the amount of fire, it's a miracle. And I wouldn't say it's a miracle. It's really a testament to the disaster management efforts of the state of California. I mean, they're just brilliant. I see it time after time, you know, how good and efficient they are. But so it's a miracle that so few houses get damaged. But houses do get damaged. They do get burned down. And there is, again, I wouldn't have been able to feel it this much if I didn't think that my house had burned down. So I now totally understand what people must be going through. It's not a question of a matter of money. You know, people carry, you know, insurance, though it's true that insurance doesn't pay for everything. It doesn't pay for your memories. It doesn't pay for things which just cannot be replaced. And it's just the sense of violation that, you know, these things which you have obviously some attachment, some sentiment for are gone. And, you know, whenever you evacuate, and I was telling my wife this, I mean, you know, now, after the fire had passed, I found out, can you believe it, that last time when I left, I did not leave with any of my college degree originals. They were in another quote-unquote safe place, which I had forgotten right. They were in.
Thanks.
So I realized that last time I had kept the most important documents in the house. The ones that cannot be replaced, like my Jadavpur University transcripts and stuff. They had left that behind in this house. So what I'm trying to say is that you never know where all your stuff is, actually. There'll always be stuff that you later realize you forgot to take. So this it's very stressful and traumatic. And I don't know. I mean, I kind of sound millennial if I say, oh, now I want to leave this place. I really want to leave this place because I'm scared. But I've never been this scared of a place before in my life. And you would say, well, you're exaggerating. There's so many people who live it. And that's true. There's so many people who
live it. You live in West Bengal.
And the prices go, and the prices of real estate here, like skyrocketing. I mean, places catch fire. The very places that catch fire, the houses there are selling for $1.5 million. The houses which are right next to the places which caught fire. And, you know, perhaps they're burned down now, but within a year, the grass will come back and they will be as exposed. So they're 1.4, it just doesn't make sense to me, but people still want to stay in the state. And then there is this, of course, the ever-present fear of like an earthquake of the kind that people have, you know. Like I stay in a place called Porter Ranch, which is right next to another place called Northridge, which you guys can Google. In mid-994, it had a huge earthquake, which basically flattened the shopping mall here. The entire two-story shopping mall was flattened. There was nothing left of it because that was perhaps where the epicenter was. One of the old employees in our office said that when they went to where I work, they thought that, oh, nothing's really happened because the outside was intact. They went in, they found that the second floor had fallen onto the first floor. So while from outside you could not see anything, inside the building was gone. So, and since it, I guess nobody was at work, so nobody died. But you can imagine, you know, what would have happened if people were inside that room. So, let's
got,
move on.
Yeah, we've got loads of stories. What do you want to start with?
Okay, so let's start with the elections.
Did you follow them closely? Aren't you tired of elections, honestly?
I am, you know, I don't know whether, I actually, you're right, I didn't follow this election as closely as I have followed other elections. That is true. But I think that the reason for that is, you know, in a way, I already knew what was going to happen. One of the big problems this time, and again, BJP's super success over the last few elections has set is a very high standard. Now, they not only have to be the single largest party, they always have to form the government and they always need to be able to cross the majority line by themselves. And anything less than that is a failure. And this is a problem that most Bengalis can kind of recognize, because this is what, you know, parental expectations are. So I said in my article in Times of India with Abhijit Banerjee winning the Nobel Prize, that is now the standard. Like, did you win the Nobel Prize? Oh, okay, all right. Well, when is that happening? So similar to that, I think the BJP is now feeling the pinch of really high expectations. And obviously, BJP's opponents in the media, of which there are many, will obviously try to play it up, because obviously the benchmark for Congress is, did Congress, get 20 or 30 seats? That's really the benchmark for their success. Well, for the BJP, it is, were they the single largest party in terms of, could they cross the 50% line? Given that, of course, this was a failure for the BJP, because they obviously did not, and I think it was, I would say that, you know, beware of your friends more than of your enemies. I think the biggest problem is because of the right. of the kind of hype that Times Now and Republic did, which, again, as I've said multiple times, I think Republic and Times Now are like the dredges of journalism. They're the dredges of journalism, and it's okay to take a nationalist right wing or whatever you want to call it, a nationalist, let's call it a nationalist angle, but at least you have to pretend to be a journalist. You have to keep up certain journalistic standards. It's okay to be biased, but it's also imperative that you keep at least a modicum of pretense. And especially with Republic, I think even more than Times Now, is that it just takes you like two minutes for an independent observer to realize that they're watching trash. And, you know, the thing with NDTV, though, even though as much as I hate NDTV, at least NDTV, you know, you can sit through their programs. I mean, surely they're biased. Surely, you know, the likes of Nidhi and all, they're the kind of ask leading questions. And that's okay, I believe. I mean, it is the channel which caters to people of a certain political bias. That is their business model. So obviously they will pander to that base. And I think that the Times Now is doing it. But by kaise kar rahe ho? That is the point. With Times Now, it's not even that like mild leading questions or like silencing some guy who's, or deplatforming. I mean, the main thing with NDTV is they will not call people who can call their BS out. They will just deplatform them. With Arnab Goswami, it's not that. You know, he doesn't care who he calls, actually, because he doesn't let anybody speak. So, you know, who cares? And I think what they did was, because of their desperate need for TRP and their desperate need to make money, you know, they basically say what their base wants to hear. So they kind of carry these inflated polls without realizing that's, you know, in two or three days when the truth will come out, this will be spun as a defeat of the very party that they so obviously support. But in a way, I don't think they're dumb. They're obviously smart people. They realize that. But what they want to do is, on that day, you know, they first want to get their results out before the other channels do it. So this is important for very obvious financial reasons. So I honestly don't think that, and we've seen these polls going so wrong. time after time. So I don't think that there's a lot of science behind it. I don't think people have, I mean, there is a science behind polling, of course. There is a science behind predictions, but I don't think that all the steps are followed. I think the main thing is, boss, we need something by 8 o'clock tonight. So do whatever you want. 8 o'clock, maybe we want some numbers, whether those numbers are true or not, dekha jayega. But those numbers must pander to our audience. Bus, yehi do requirement hai, bus baki tumhara kaam. So this kind of journalism, if I can call journalism, is, you know, it doesn't even serve the messaging goals that Times Now and Arnab have at this point of time. Because the problem is, they, in order for a right-wing/nationalist media ecosystem to persist, the first thing it needs to establish is a baseline of credibility. They have to do it. And even over here, Fox News, you know, they had, you know, they have journalists like Chris Wallace. They had good journalists. You know, those people are not given prominence. You know, prominence was Bill O'Reilly and Hannity. But because those are the guys who really get the eyeballs. But in order for them, and even then, nobody considers Fox News seriously. But even then, Fox News makes the attempt. So, you know, Chris Cuomo, for instance, who's this guy on CNN, his first place he worked was Fox News. Because Roger Ailes got people who, you know, in order, and that's something which Roger Ailes understood, that in order for him to create a right-wing media empire, what he needs is, he needs some form of legitimacy. Though there needs to be some people, might not be given like the first, the most prominent positions or the most prominent programming slots, but there needs to be some people who at least appear to be fair, who at least appear to present all sides, who at least appear to follow standard journalistic practices. And then at the 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock prime time slot, you give it to the people who were there just for gali galoch. You give it to that. Okay, fine. That's when people tune in for the fun. So he did. He had Bill O'Reilly. He had Sean Hannity. He still has Sean Hannity, by the way. So that works. But unfortunately, Indians have only taken that part. They haven't invested the time in, and it's specifically true for Times Now and Republic TV. I think this is not true for NDTV. NDTV, at least, you know, when you sit through an hour of their programming, you think, okay, at least they let the people speak. At least they let this guy speak. Of course, it was very obvious how much time this guy was given. Or, you know, as I've said before, one of the things that NDTV does is it will bring the right-wing guy who is the most extreme, inarticulate, moronic, who by the very purpose, the very expedient of opening his mouth, automatically damns his cause. So they will obviously go for that. And for the opinion that they support, they will bring the most erudite guy. So of course they do that kind of things, but this is a second level of jugglery. The problem with Arnab is that he does the first level of this. He just doesn't let anybody speak and, you know, kind of gives these false facts. I would say this is definitely, you know, I'm not going to accept that this was just an opinion poll which went wrong. And this is not as a persistent, sometimes BJP does, of course, exceptionally well. In those cases, this is like the parrot, you know, parrot doing horoscope, you know, that kind of thing. So obviously sometimes the BJP will outperform expectations, and then Arnab will say, look, we are the guys who predicted it. Of course. Okay, so moving on to the next story. It will be interesting, by the way, to see how things play out between Sena and BJP, because BJP hasn't been a particularly reliable and trustworthy ally in multi-party alliances. It's a very different BJP from the BJP of Vajpayee, for instance, because there's a different objective of Vajpayee, of the BJP under Vajpayee, which was, and the more aggressive BJP under Amit Shah, which essentially wants to dominate the Indian political landscape. And there's nothing wrong in that. I think every political party wants to dominate. I think the Congress wanted to dominate and had dominated for a long time, and because of reasons that have been discussed multiple times in this podcast, that it is no longer in a position to do so. But I think it will be interesting to see now that I think that Shiv Sena has, I think in Indian politics, it's very important to get a personality front and center. So I think now that Thackeray Jr. is...
Aditya Thackeray.
Aditya Thackeray, who
unlike his father, Aditya Thackeray does have some amount of charisma. He's young. He's a good-looking guy. He doesn't have Rahul Gandhi's baggage, and you know he talks the talk. I think it's amusing to see our liberal media getting behind Aditya Thackeray, given the history of Shiv Sena and his grandfather. But again, you know, things change, and I'd be interested to see if he can make. I'm pretty sure that's one of his ambitions. If he can try to go national, I think that one of the things that the Modi opposition is struggling with is they can't put a face up against Modi. The problem is that ultimately people vote for him. They don't really vote for economy. They vote for people. They vote for a person. They vote for a person who they feel is leadership material, who they can trust to be a leader. And right now, for good or for bad, depending on which side of the political spectrum you are, there is nobody other than Modi that people feel anything in terms of leadership. And it's true that I think that in state elections, BJP, you know, the Modi factor is never that much in a state election because people, you know, people in India understand democracy. You know, that there's no way that democracy could have persisted for so long if there wasn't a rudimentary understanding of democracy. And people realize that, you know, Modi is great, and they gave a resounding verdict from Modi. And even if another election to the central government was held, Modi would still win with this amount of margin. But for state, I think people are more looking at local issues. They're more looking at the local leadership. They're more looking at the chief minister. And they're more looking at personalities, but at the local level. And of course, if there's to be any opposition from Modi, it's obviously not going to come from the Congress, given the way that it has gone back to Sonia Gandhi. So it'll obviously have to look for somebody. I obviously think that Arvind Kejriwal still wants to be that person. But I think he's realized his mistake. Last time he was just a little bit too hasty. You know, he had barely settled into as chief minister and he just quit and tried to become the prime minister. And I think the electorate punished him for that. And I think he's taken that to heart. I mean, of course, it's a political gambit. I'm pretty sure he's nothing like that. But for the last, I would say, about few months, you would find that Arvind Kejriwal has been less aggressive against Modi.
Yes, appreciating the government every now and then.
So he's realized that he just cannot, that he's not still at the stature that he can go on toe-to-toe with Modi, that it makes much more sense to basically play that Modi at the center and I am at Delhi. I mean, that is a much better card for him to play at this point of time. Obviously, he's not going to keep on playing this card. This is a pretense. There's no change in him fundamentally, but at least strategically he's playing his cards much better now than he was playing them a few months ago. Okay, moving on from one person who wants to be king to the prince who became king. Saurav Ganguly ascended to the top leadership of like the king of BCCI, you know. And that picture of him, and that widely circulated picture of him looking out over from his window, is just reminded me so much of Shah Rukh Khan in Bali, taking over Madan Chopra's chair and like kind of rotating rapidly. I'm pretty sure Ganguly did that before that picture was taken. And I think that nobody knows how Ganguly's tenure will go, but I think this is a very encouraging sign. Because one of the great things about Ganguly is that, and this thing is, by the way, is even before Ganguly became the BCCI president, even before his name had been brought up, Shoaib Akhtar, in his very entertaining YouTube channel, which I recommend all of you guys watch, even if you're not really interested in cricket, but he was saying that. And by the way, have you ever seen them, Vikram, any of these?
I've seen a couple which you shared on Twitter.
Okay. So their basic message, so it's usually Rashid Latif and, you know, all these people who find themselves unable to get into the correct Pakistani cricket administration. So their basic, whenever they bring India up, they really like say, like, India is great.
I mean, look at Indian side. I mean, look at their side, like the amount of options that they have. People scored a triple century and then they don't get to play a test match again. The people are forgotten. I mean, people like Prithvi Shaw, everybody was talking, you know, one performance bad and there he's gone. There's a new guy who comes and hits a double century. You know, look at this country and look at where we are. We have to go back to those same goddamn old faces again and again. And then they say, but Indians, of course, suck in sports. Okay, we know that we are much better than them. And the reason why this has happened, you know, remember when we used to be players, you know, we used to laugh at them. You know, they were unfit. They didn't even know how to, they were scared of our, you know, my bowling, these guys. But then, you know, over the years, while we basically did nothing, you know, this is when Shoaib Akhtar started with Ganguly, really changed everything. He changed the very way that they came to the crease. He changed their very way of looking. Even if they couldn't bat, you know, they didn't let it on that much. They were not defeated before they came onto the pitch. They fought. And, you know, he created a team. He created an infrastructure. He was given that influence. And look at where they are now. Look at where they are now. Look at where we are now. We should be ashamed. I feel ashamed when we now go and play India. You know, they're not even like man to man. If I look at anyone, there is nobody who can come. Maybe Babar Azam can come to somebody in their team. But look at anybody else. Do a comparison. It's just embarrassing. So their main thing is we are better than them, but because essentially the method is since the Pakistan Cricket Board hasn't made any of us important people, we are in this shithole. So anyways, but they were very, very, they're praising Ganguly before they made it. And then Shoaib Akhtar said, of course, that of course I said this and then they made it. Of course, they were listening to me. But I think this is a great move. I think one of the greatest things about Ganguly was, you know, no matter what an opinion you may have about him as a batsman, and I honestly, even as a fan of Ganguly, I'll say he was not a great test batsman. You know, he was a good one-day batsman. I wouldn't say he was a great one-day batsman either, but he was a good one-day batsman for his time. But he was definitely a great cricket captain. Not so much, you know, strategy, it's okay. I mean, there are other smart people also, but the kind of team that he built together, the kind of love and respect that people who played with him have for him, I think that's fairly unique. You know, you listen to any interview from Sehwag or Yuvraj or Harbhajan and the kind of loyalty that they still have for Saurav Ganguly is just amazing. And that tells you something, you know. We did a past episode where we compared captains with, you know, corporate managers. And the really successful manager isn't the guy who's basically brought in great results. It's the guy for whom the people who work under him are willing to die for. You know, that is the kind of leadership, you know, that they know that this guy has my back. No matter, you know, I can always trust him. That kind of trust that somebody has, I mean, that I think is the pinnacle of what leadership is. It's not so much success, because ultimately your success as a leader depends on the people you're leading. It just can't be you. So in many ways, that is always there. And when you judge a leader, sometimes leaders are lucky because they just have great people working for them. But where the real mark of a leader is how people who work under you perceive you. Because there's obviously a power gradient here. There's obviously going to be times when you feel that something needs to be done and the leader basically says no. But even then, so there's an inherent conflict. You know, this guy is sitting here, he's dropping people. So there's always a conflict. It's kind of built into the relationship between the leader and the led. But even after this, if the led can spontaneously really love their leader to the emotional, and it's not that he's there, these guys are saying this because Ganguly is still their captain. He's not captain, he doesn't even play anymore. He's no influence over their lives. But yet, the amount of love that they have for him attests to something of his ability as a leader, that even with these people who are superstars in their own respect, that they still, you know, say, you know, he was a great captain, or, you know, I owe everything to him. They say that every time. They don't need to, but they do. So I think it's great that he has become, firstly, I think he's the first cricketer, if I'm not wrong, to be, you know, somebody who's played cricket, to be the BCCI president.
The first well-known one. Apparently, there was somebody way back.
Is anybody BCCI president who's ever played cricket as a test cricketer? I'm not sure. But this is definitely overdue. Of course, I mean, political interference is obviously going to be there because, you know, you have Amit Shah's son there also. Now we kind of going to see a new generation. And of course, everybody, BCCI is, I would say, it's, you know, being part of BCCI is one of the most profitable Indian companies, I would say. And a company which I'm pretty sure is kind of assured of its profits. Is this something which, you know, Amazon or a Chinese company really can't compete on? They have kind of a monopoly on a sport. And I think, you know, if I was a, you know, if BCCI had, I would definitely buy BCCI stock. Definitely.
It's a good retirement stock.
It's a good retirement stock. It's a solid hold stock, man. It's great stock. So I don't want to, you know, get ahead of myself and say this is going to solve BCCI problems. Of course, we have to see. But I think what you're going to see after this is I hope that Ganguly brings in greater transparency of the BCCI, greater transparency in financial matters. I hope that he resolves some of the very naughty, and naughty as in not N-A-U-G-H-T, but K-N-O-T-T-Y, naughty conflict of interest problems that are all over the board. I think he mentioned that also. And I believe that this might, because I know this is one of Ganguly's pet projects, is we might see an alteration in the kind of pitches that we have. I think he's been saying it for a long time that he wants more international quality pitches rather than dust bowls and spin tracks.
Currently, his tenure is only for 9 months, isn't it?
Oh, well, and what happens after that?
I believe there will be a fresh election. I'm not sure about the details of it, but the reason why Ganguly had to come in and unopposed was because to get rid of the Supreme Court appointed, you know, your Ram Guhas and all of them. So right. They had to get Ganguly on. And then I think after 9 months, there has to be a mandated elections.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see who stands against Ganguly. I hope it's Ravi Shastri though, but let's see. Ex-Indian coach Ravi Shastri stands for election. But it'll be good to see. I doubt in India, you know, I think it's going to be unopposed, unanimous. I think the BCCI suffers from the exact same problem that most of our institutions suffer from, that they do not take elections very well. An election is seen as a direct, conflict. It's not like, this is ingrained into the Indian structure. I mean, that's, Gandhi basically kicked out, Mahatma Gandhi basically kicked out Netaji from the Congress party when Netaji went and fought an election against Gandhi's chosen candidate and won. So he, and that, of course, Mahatma Gandhi, the doyen of democracy, just could not take. So this has again been a persistent problem in India, that there's this need for, you know, elections, especially in political parties or places like BCCI, have to be a formality. They have to be unanimous. Unfortunately, this is one of the good things about the US in terms of, you know, the Democratic primaries or the Republican primaries, is that they allow people to compete in a very open fashion. And this is what keeps the parties together. I mean, if for instance, Sharad Pawar was able to run against Sonia Gandhi for the leadership of the Congress, then maybe they wouldn't have had to leave. This is one of the big problems with Congress. So I think this is the reason why, you know, Democratic Party doesn't split, because it does allow everybody, it does allow the progressive left branch of the party to openly go up and attack the centrist, the centrist core of the party, and they go and they have like an election which goes on 50 states. It's a huge amounts of money are spent, but then whoever loses realizes that we lost because we lost.
Right.
There's no backroom machinations which are leading to, you know, we will make Biden. I mean, that really happened in the last time. That's what Hillary did, though. Hillary did a very desi thing there by basically sabotaging the elections, the inter-party elections against Bernie. And this is the reason, this is the principle on which Tulsi Gabbard basically resigned. I mean, that's the reason why, you know, we had this almost unprecedented, attack that Hillary Clinton launched on Tulsi Gabbard, calling her a Russian asset, which is like the, even Bernie later on came out and said, look, you might not agree with what she's doing. We can't call somebody a Russian spy, you know, with zero. I mean, this is a person who's served for the for the country who served tours of Iraq, who's a sitting, you know, sitting member of the House of Representatives, you know, accusing that person. I think she might be on some of the intelligence committees also to accuse such a person to be a spy for Russia. It's just a, and who's accusing? It's not some, you know, some random guy. It's a person who served as a Secretary of State. So you have to understand where it's coming from, who's saying it. I mean, this was almost unprecedented. I mean, this is, you know, for Trump, this is accepted. The Trump calls anybody, you know, humans scum, whatever, that's okay. And, you know, calling someone human scum is a gali, that's okay. But calling somebody a Russian spy without, you know, a trace of evidence and coming from Hillary Clinton, it's just unprecedented hatred for someone. And where does this coming from? This is coming from the fact that, you know, at one point of time, Tulsi Gabbard was being considered by the Democrats to be kind of the face of the next generation of their party, till she decided to go against Hillary Clinton because, you know, Debbie Wasserman Schultz and all that gang were basically colluding to the extent that, you know, one of the CNN anchors actually gave the questions that were going to be asked in the CNN debate before to Hillary Clinton. This is the classic, you know, exam leak in India. And so, Donna Brazil, I think, was his name. And she, by the way, has now become a commentator on Fox, just as a rejoinder. So, again, we were coming to, but we kind of, you know, lost focus. But this is exactly what happens. And as you can see, the fact that democracy did not succeed there, inter-party, is now we have a very desi fight where one person is calling the other person, you know, something terrible without, you know, without any kind of evidence. And this is again one of the reasons why I was so opposed to Hillary Clinton, because of, you know, I stand by some of her principles. You know, I think that, you know, as a centrist, moderate Democratic candidate, she had, you know, fairly decent ideas. She has fairly workable ideas. I mean, many of the things that Bernie and these people are suggesting, they know very well that they will not pass Congress. There's no way that these things will pass. Universal health care will not pass. But they still promise it. Hillary, at least, she always was all about making promises that she felt she could keep. So there was very incremental, small promises. So I appreciated that part of her. But this part of her, this is the reason why she lost, really. And why people would support somebody like Trump, at least, over her. She was the only person against whom Trump can win, could have won an election, and the Democrats went with her. Anyways, moving on to the next topic, which was, you know, Kohli's five venue formula. I think it was interesting, and I'm kind of conflicted about this. I honestly feel that, I mean, I think where Kohli is coming from is he's coming from the way test matches happen in other parts of the world, where, you know, every country has their fixed set of four or five stadiums where they have test matches, and they don't normally, there's no, you know, it's very standard. When you go to England, you have Lord's, Leeds, Old Trafford, you know, that's it, you know, they're not. And there's not some other place, you know, the test match suddenly doesn't happen in Ireland or Scotland or some other place. But so, I don't know. I mean, I honestly feel that test matches, the best places to hold test matches is in, you know, not in those five places. I think that in one of the things that, you know, watching a test match, especially for a budding cricketer, it's a very different watching a cricket match in the ground versus watching it on television. Having watched a cricket match on the ground, I can tell you that. I think many of you have. It's a very different experience. And I think it's more important that people in states, cities like Cuttack and, you know, Trivandrum, you know, they have that experience. And if Kohli's problem is that people don't come into the games, then that's a different problem. The reason why people often don't come to games is because of the, you know, how anti-spectator the Indian cricket watching experience is. One of the big problems is that because of security, because of, you know, it's just, I mean, going to watch cricket in Eden Gardens. I mean, the last time I went to watch cricket was for IPL, and that the facilities were, well, I had tickets I watched it in like one of those corporate boxes. Fortunately, I got access there. So, So, of course, the experience was different. But I remember watching Test cricket in the Eden Gardens. And it was a nightmare. It was a friggin' nightmare. You couldn't bring water from outside. Water would run out from inside. It would be like being in the black hole of Calcutta. And, of course, just because of the size of Calcutta and just because of the cricket-mad nature, I think it's kind of changing over nowadays. People would still come there. People would still pack this. You know, It would do these small concrete seats where you would have to like kind of sit with your foot, you know, one leg on top of each other. That was all you got. And they used to heat up in the sun. And so these were the cheap seats. This is where I used to watch cricket from with my father. And it was a terrible experience. You know, the whole cricket watching experience, but in those days, nobody really cared. People didn't even understand the notion of an user experience at this point of time. You were lucky to be even be able to get into the side, you know, count your lucky stars that you're inside and not one of the 20,000 people standing outside the stadium hoping for tickets. So I think expectations were different then, but expectations have changed now. I think one of the reasons, and Kohli, with his influence, should be talking about that rather than like disenfranchising so-called B-level cities. So he should be talking about, because he has the traction, he has the influences. How can we improve? How can we improve the experience of people? And I think that Australia, they do this, but they, you know, schools bring their kids along for free. Why don't you do that? Pretty sure school kids, for a day off from school, to go to a cricket match for free, they will go. They would love it. I would have loved it. So there are ways of bringing in more spectators. I understand that for cricketers, it's important to have a crowd. I think no cricketer can really motivate himself in front of, you know, empty crowds. I think that's true. I think that, you know, when you have top sportsmen, any sportsman, you know, it's not just the money. I mean, sure, it's the money. But the reason why they play is because of the adulation. Not through television, but through the direct adulation of seeing people who are there to watch them. That's why, you know, people from Kapil Dev to Sachin Tendulkar to Mahendra Singh Dhoni have such a tough time retiring. They have such a tough time retiring. Why do they have such a tough time retiring? Do you think it's money? No, they don't give a shit for money. They would more likely like to play for free if possible, if they could suggest that. But it's just that they just cannot let go of that adulation, that's really what you know, for champion sportsmen, that is the rush, you know, to go into a stadium packed with people calling out their name. That is that rush. And nobody, I can hardly see anybody who can let go of that. Just cannot let go. So I think with Sokoli, I understand where he's coming from, but I think the solution is not, you know, deplatforming, you know, these cities that Kohli is suggesting. I think it's more important is how to get people in. That is a more constructive way of solving the problem. I think in a place like India, in a country in India, with so many people, and which I think it's impractical to expect that all test matches will be held in the four metros in Bangalore. And I also don't know why Kohli thinks that, you know, test matches should be held in Bangalore, given his own, you know, amazing record for that city.
I thought so too.
I think you should talk about some other cities. When I said five cities, I didn't mean Bangalore. Please, not that one. Okay. So the next topic is, of course, the U.S. congressional hearings on Kashmir. Now, before I even start this one, all of, you know, my audience, I guess many of you know this, but for those of you who don't know, this doesn't count for jack shit. These kind of congressional hearings happen like all the time. And in many of these congressional hearings, the guys who are supposed to be on the committee don't even freaking show up. So if you watch that, you'll see some guy comes and says, "Apologize, I wasn't here earlier." So that person just basically...
They had one for Facebook also, I believe, this week.
Yeah. So again, so they have a lot of these going on. Now, of course, when you have Mark Zuckerberg there, there's obviously going to be more attention, right? You know, in general, everybody in the world cares about Mark Zuckerberg because he's a superstar. So those things do get a lot of attention. So when you have even the House of Rep, even the congressmen, they will go there. Because they want to be seen. So they want to be seen grilling Mark Zuckerberg. You know, just like AOC, you know, she grills him. He kind of, you know, blubbers the answer. So, you know, AOC looks awesome. You know, of course, you know, AOC is very good at these things. So I mean, those are the things which definitely do get attention. But just as a point of context, there are a gazillion number of these congressional hearings happening at any point of time, from, you know, emergency response in Idaho to something or the other. Okay, so, you know, so per se, it's not an event of great significance. As a matter of fact, it had virtually no coverage over here in the news, virtually none. The only people who were obsessed about it were, of course, Indians in India. Okay, so I think what I found interesting, and again, Ilhan Omar, of course, you know, there was a lot of talk about Ilhan Omar and her, you know, her behavior. And the point is, again, that Ilhan Omar is well known for that. I mean, Ilhan Omar is a strong, let's say, is definitely, okay, so before I say anything about Ilhan Omar, let me read to you a slightly lengthy extract from what the Washington Post writes about Ilhan Omar in an opinion piece. Okay. So this was written in the context of Ilhan Omar being banned by Israel. So if you may know that Ilhan Omar was banned from visiting Israel because she is part of a lobby which essentially calls for boycotting of all goods made by Israel. A total boycott, and she supports a one-state solution, that is, no Israel. So this is what Washington Post, which I guess all of us can agree is not a right-wing media organization in the U.S. context, says. Omar has said that when she hears people call Israel a democracy, I almost chuckle. I'm quoting from the Washington Post article. The title of the article is, if Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib can boycott Israel, why can't Israel boycott them? It's written by Mark Thiessen. So she has said, Israel has hypnotized the world, has declared her hope that Allah will awaken the people and help them see the evil doings of Israel, supports a boycott of Israel, a country she has compared to Nazi Germany. Side note, India was, again, the RSS was compared to Nazis in this deposition. Accused her house colleagues, that her own colleagues who support Israel, of pushing for allegiance to a foreign country, and declared that support for Israel is all about the Benjamins. She later apologized for the last comment, but not all the others before or since that one. How is it that she continues to sit on the congressional committee that helps set U.S. policy towards Israel? When Rep. Steve King defended white supremacist views, the GOP leadership in the House stripped him of his committee assignments and voted 424-1 on a resolution condemning the Iowa Republican. Yet after Omar made virulently anti-Semitic comments, Democratic leaders in the House could not bring themselves to do the same. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi actually defended Omar's allegiance to a foreign country remark. Note, it's very similar to what Hillary Clinton said about that, you know, allegiance to a foreign country, which is what Hillary Clinton accused Rep. Tulsi Gabbard of, saying, I don't believe it was intended in an anti-Semitic way. I'm sorry, what other way could she have intended it? Can you imagine if Republicans had defended King, saying, I don't believe it was intended in a white supremacist way? End extract from Washington Post. So the point about Ilhan Omar is that Ilhan Omar is Ilhan Omar, and she represents a rather extreme view in the U.S. politics, and I honestly feel it. She's not going to be able to sustain herself, given the kind of in anti-Semitism, being Hindu-phobic is not a problem in the U.S. because nobody, you know, hey, who even knows who we are, but you know, being anti-Semitic as she is, and being publicly being called an anti-Semite by Washington Post, yeah, this is usually not a good thing for her career. So in a way, what she says, the weight of her words ultimately have been compromised by her own past words. So I think that nobody should really take her seriously. And thankfully, she has spoken too many times now for anybody other than the persons who are, of course, solely and absolutely aligned with her worldview, in which case, you know, logic doesn't matter. So, you know, we're not reaching those people. But I think that anybody with any kind of brain would not consider her, would know where she's coming from and what she supports. And by the way, she didn't call anybody, you know, I don't think, as far as I know, she called Indians or Hindus or the state of India facet. I don't think she did that. I think she was trying to be a little subtle, you know, do we share your values? You guys are good, but what have you been doing? So if you look at what she said, it wasn't that terrible. It wasn't that terrible, of course. The terrible things were said by, you know, Indians/Hindus, okay, about us. And it was the same old, you know, Natasha Kaul, Angana Chatterjee. You know who these people are. I think that the most interesting thing, and I think that Aarti Tikku Singh, you know, I understand where she was coming from, but given that she was up against people who were not going to talk about the other side, for her also to talk about, you know, army atrocities, I think I understand where she was coming from. As a journalist, it's important to say the both sides of the story. It's important to kind of appear neutral. But the other people on that committee were not bothered with that. And this is the thing about these committees. First of all, you know, she read there was a 7-minute, you know, she was stopped and she said, what was the name of that guy? Hold on. Representative Brad Sherman, who was chairing the committee, just said, you have 5 minutes. And she was basically getting started reading. So she was not prepared for the whole that, you know, you have to wrap it up within 5 minutes. You have to give your punchline at the end of 5 minutes. She was reading a written statement. So I was wondering where the preparation for this was. And even the narrative that she chose to go with, like everybody is responsible for it. And, you know, she had her 5 minutes to talk about, she was given 5 minutes to talk about what happened to pundits. And she virtually never did it. I mean, it was lost amidst all other things that she talked about. Yeah, sure, she went after Pakistan, said Pakistan's doing this, Pakistan's doing that. But that is not really why you're there. I think when India goes to you know, a place, you know, in US and tries to say Pakistan does this, Pakistan, it makes us look weak. It makes us look at their level. That's what Pakistan does. Wherever they go, they say India does this, India does that. You know, let them do that. That attests to their weakness. That attests to the fact that their main obsession is everything in our country is happening. It's happening because India is doing it. Indians, we have to take the things which are happening in Kashmir aren't happening all because of Pakistan. Sure, they're making things worse. Sure, they're fanning terrorism in Kashmir. But Kashmir is not per se. It's not that Pakistan is doing everything in Kashmir. So address what happened. Address, make the point that this is not just the way you target it is as a freedom struggle of a group. This is a legacy of partition. This is a legacy of communal politics. That this is not a revolt of a state, a Kashmir state against the Indian state. It is a communal conflict. It is based on religion. Make those points. That is what, if you get 5 minutes to speak in front of US congressmen, that is what you should go with. And no, you don't have to monkey balance when you get 5 minutes, because there are people standing there on your side who outnumber you by 2-1 who are not going to monkey balance like you. They are not going to show the other side. So I understand there's a basic human being, as you know, a journalist, you're supposed to show both sides. I totally understand that, and I totally understand where she's coming from. But unfortunately, given the context in which she's been placed in, totally outnumbered by people who represent the opposite side, it would have made much more sense for her to use the 5 minutes. Not that these things don't convince anyone. As I said, these are things that are of little significance. They're mostly, you know, a little bit of grandstanding. And which leads me to the final 2 degrees. So I think one of the things that that Aarti Tikku Singh said was that she found that Brad Sherman was, Brad Sherman, who was chairing the committee, she felt that he didn't let her speak.
Now, here is where, you know, almost the usual suspect's twist is. I will provide you a link from opensecrets.org, which say, you know, and I am going to send it so that I don't forget it to Vikram right now. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked when, because I've never heard of this guy before, Brad Sherman. I don't follow US politics that one. And one of his top contributors for 2019 to 2020, can you guess who one of his top contributors are, Vikram?
No clue.
Take a wild guess.
Well, assuming it's from left, I don't know. I have no idea.
Hindu American PSE. He has taken $10,000 from my Hindu
There's something American like that.
Lobbyist PAC.
Yikes.
This I
How found... does that even work?
Excuse me?
How? Oh, I didn't know there's even such a thing.
Yeah. So the way it works is that, you know, lobbying groups have these PACs. So these PACs, when you donate to a PAC, you basically have... The PACs are not obliged
to reveal, as
an individual contributor, if you give, let's say, that's why Bernie and these guys say, we don't take money from PACs.
We don't accept, right.
So when you take money from PACs, there is no contribution limits. And nobody knows who the money that the PAC gave actually came from. So the PACs are not obliged to tell you what the source of their income, that money is. So they're often called dark money.
Political bonds in India.
Yeah. So they're under no obligation. However, if you take individual contributions from people, then that is in public record. So if I gave $200 to Bernie, you can find that out. However, if I give $200 to a super PAC and the super PAC gives the money, you can never trace it back to me. So there is a Hindu American PAC, which I did not know existed. And they apparently gave $10,000, which is not too little, I would say, given the amount of money he has from other places. I mean, they're one of his largest donors. And this is the guy who essentially packs that committee with people who, let's say, do not represent the interests of the guys who paid him $10,000. So normally what we hear is that, so this I think attests to the pathetic lobbying activities of the people, I think. I mean, if you're paying somebody $10,000 and this is what he does for you, then obviously there's something going wrong with your...
Yeah. Does he have a money-back guarantee or something?
I don't know. I think if it's 90 days, they should try to get their money back from this guy. But I sent you the link and it's there. And I was quite shocked. I did not see that coming. Because what I do normally is whenever I see a representative, I always go out and see who's paying for him. So in America, it's actually very simple. In a way, it's kind of open. That unlike in India, where you really don't know who's paying for this guy. In America, at least you get some idea. I mean, if you go to the Open Secrets, you'll find that he got $10,000 from Credit Union National Association, American Land Title Association, BQE Software, Investment Co. Institute. And it also has a pie chart based on, you know, the most amount of money he's gotten is from the industry securities and investment. Then he's gotten $33,000 from real estate. So, I mean, he has like small contributions that is less than $200. He has like 1.44% of his war kitty is from that, which is a very low. With large individual contributions, he has 42%. From PAC contributions, which is the dark money comes from, he's 52%. So, and again, these are the things which Bernie doesn't take. Bernie and all of the progressives, they don't take. Bernie doesn't take. Elizabeth Warren doesn't take. This guy is taking from a PAC right now. Biden is. But Warren doesn't take. Bernie has never taken. That's why I used to admire him. He's the guy who stood firm on his principles. He's never taken. Warren isn't taking, I'm not sure about Kamala and the rest, but I think pretty much all the progressives in the Democrat Party, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez doesn't take. I don't think Ilhan Omar also takes. So that you have to say. So So none of them take. So this is now pretty fashionable in US progressive cycles, which is just to say, I do not take money from any PACs or any large contributions from companies. I just take money from individuals, less than $200, all accountable, all searchable, all you can find out who paid me. So it's fully transparent political funding, which is, of course, a very brave move. And, I think this is the way politics should be, but I'm pretty sure this is not the way politics can be. So the final thing that I want to conclude with is, did you get the link? Just check if you got the link.
Yes, I do. I have it. It'll be there in the show notes for our listeners.
Yes. So for those who are listeners, please look at the show notes. So when you open the show notes, it's if you have to select something, I think it's already pre-selected, but select a cycle 2020, which is the next, and you'll find that look at the top contributors, 2019 to 2020. So it's not even old contributions. These are fresh contributions. So last thing I wanted to do was, again, wish you happy Diwali. I think there's always a controversy about bursting of crackers around this time and whether it's... So here's what I have to say about this. I think that it's important that that behaviors evolve. And saying bursting crackers is fun. Definitely they're fun. I've enjoyed bursting crackers. This is why I used to enjoy Diwali, sometimes even more than I used to enjoy Durga Puja, because there was not much for me to do during Durga Puja, but during Kali Puja. You don't celebrate Diwali, you celebrate Kali Puja. In Kolkata, the fun was the tubri, the fun was the rocket, the fun was the dodoma, the fun was the sharp bhaji. And the fact is, we should evolve. I understand that they're fun, but we have to consider the environment. I mean, things have gotten worse. Okay, and it's important that we evolve. There were modes of entertainment in those days that were not available, that are now available. There are games, there's computer games, there's so many things. So, the entertainment landscape has changed also. So it's kind of churlish to, let's just keep religion to the side for it. There's nothing religious about bursting crackers. Absolutely. And given our increased awareness of the environment, given the fact that things are getting worse in terms of the environment, I mean, there is no doubt about it, that maybe it is time that we evolve, we recognize the fact that, yes, we had this, it's fun, but we evolve. This does not also mean that there is also a hypocrisy with respect to this. This is, again, comes back to my favorite topic, which is punching up, punching down. That is only certain there's only certain religious occasions where environment comes up. And it's absolutely right to call out the hypocrisy of people who think nothing of bursting crackers during their own occasions, their own functions, their own weddings. And then they complain before Diwali. And think that this kind of it's hypocrisy stems from the way we look at the environment, that we always think that our action is okay. It's only when we look at other people's actions that they should sacrifice for the environment. That is the fundamental problem. That how dare you think. That the problem comes from that the people who are saying how dare you are often the people who live environmentally unsustainable lifestyles. It comes from a person like Al Gore, who flies around in his own private jet. But he raises awareness. His supporters will say his main role is to increase awareness. But that doesn't mean that he himself lives an environmentally sustainable lifestyle. He doesn't. And that, I think, is precisely where an essential hypocrisy of all environmentalism comes in. And I've often seen in my own personal experience that the people who actually live environmental sustainable lives, who actually do things for the environment, they normally don't lecture other people about the environment. They're actually too busy doing the things. To actually lecture other people. So I think both of it is true, that there is a hypocrisy that needs to be called out here. But it also doesn't mean that just because there is hypocrisy, that the core issue isn't that we should keep on bursting crackers. I think that the amount of smoke, the amount of pollution, I mean, I remember when the sharp bhaji, I don't know what it's called in Hindi, but what is it called, in India, Vikram? It's these small, like, black tablets, which if you set fire to it...
The snake tablets, yeah.
Snake tablets. So, I remember even just standing next to it, I could feel that like basically cancer in a tablet. You could just feel it. That this is not good. That smell coming out was the smell of death. But I loved it.
I loved it. I would still give my, not here in California, of course, would never set anything on fire here. Because if you set anything, the entire place goes up. This is like you're living in inside a gas cylinder over here. But in India, I would love to, you know, I enjoyed so much. The main thing about Diwali wasn't the lights. It was the sound. It was the sound. It was the chocolate bombs. It was the dodomas, the boom here and the boom that goes up. But there's so many things in those days that we didn't know. We didn't know that, you know, eating carbs was bad. We didn't know. We didn't look at the label of food we ate. We didn't know all these things. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't. I have a daughter and I absolutely follow, you know, the labeling of the food that she eats. My parents didn't do this. It's not because they didn't care. Just they didn't know and there was information wasn't available. But that doesn't mean that just because I grew up like that, doesn't mean that my daughter has to grow up like that. It doesn't mean that the health issues that I live with, my daughter has to live with those health issues. When I know better that, you know, eating like this will most probably lead to health issues 30 years down the line. And we know these things now. So why not use it? I remember there was this short story by Rabindranath Tagore. Can't remember what it was, but you know, essentially the story was that I think it's Rabindranath Tagore. But story was that this person decides not to give medicine to his son's wife or something. Somebody, I don't remember, really vague memory. But I remember the line. He said, "Why do you need to take medicine? You know, your mother died without any medicine. Why do you think you're any better?" So I think that as we progress as a human civilization, as we come to know more things, and as the environment deteriorates in front of our eyes, I think it's more important for us to realize that we have to change our behavior while obviously calling out the hypocrisy. The hypocrisy exists, but the hypocrisy is, I think, not the more important thing. The more important thing is the environment. It's to make sure that, you know, we breathe, you know, the kind of permanent damage that happens to our lungs. Those things cannot be argued against. These things are not, you know, conspiracies. These things are facts. And I think we know enough, we can see the effects of that. And whether you want to burst crackers or not, again, I'm not a big fan of banning things. I think that I'm not. And the reason with banning things is that then you have a question of, well, if you're banning this for environmental reasons, then why don't you ban that of another religion for environmental reasons too? And so there's a line here, of course. But I think that as an individual modification of our behavior, this is something which is definitely worth thinking about. This is definitely something which is, it's not a wrong thing to bring it up, I would say. It's a good thing to bring it up. I wish it was brought up by people who had consistent and non-hypocritical voices, but there's nothing I can do about that. That's really the essence of what environmentalism is. It's very difficult to be consistently environmental in everything you do. It's just that our lifestyles are not meant to be environmentally sustainable. That's just human progress has brought us to a place. And some places there are people who live in, you know, in communal, in harmony with nature. You know, our ancient, you know, forefathers did. We're just too far removed from that to not be hypocritical when we're talking about environment. I mean, I know that I can't, you know, I there's a hypocrisy in me talking about environment. I eat meat. And I think that, you know, the science is out on that. Eating meat is not environmentally sustainable. But the point is, even when you're making a point, that's, I believe, is that when environmentalists want to make a point, I think it's important that they call out their own hypocrisy themselves. They say, look, I struggle with it myself. There are things which I do which are not good, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't strive to do some good in some places. While obviously we cannot be 100% good environmentally, maybe we can be 50%. Maybe that's a move forward, and maybe our next generation will be 70% there. I think it's more important for the people who are messaging this, you know, to basically call that out, to not, you know, pontificate from a you know, higher platform to say, you know, how dare you, basically, in the sense that I'm better and you are not. I think that's the problem with that message, is to say that, look, you know, I have a problem, you have a problem, why don't we solve this? And I'm good, why don't we do this small thing together? It's not because that I don't like bursting crackers. Let's just say I love bursting crackers, but I'm not going to do it. Can I convince you not to do it?
I think that should be the way the thing was messaged. I don't think there would be a lot of resistance also if you message it like that, rather than, you know, this kind of pedestal pontification. So that's it for today. And thanks a lot and happy Diwali to everybody again.
Absolutely. So yeah, like Arnab said, that's our podcast for today. And it's been one of those where we cover a wide variety of topics. And I love these ones, as I've told Arnab numerous times. I have a train to catch, so let me quickly remind you of Arnab's Patreon page. That's at patreon.com/greatbong. And also take this chance to wish you health, wealth, happiness, and a very healthy tummy after eating all those Diwali sweets. So have a great Diwali, and until next time, take care. Bye-bye.